Chapter 10. A field day and bivouac, more new friends, an invitation to the country, many authors entertain, not only a foolish, but a really dishonest objection, to acknowledge the sources, whence they derive much valuable information. We have no such feeling. We are merely endeavoring to discharge, in an upright manner, the responsible duties of our editorial functions, and whatever ambition we might have felt under other circumstances, to lay claim to the authorship of these adventures. A regard for truth forbids us to do more than claim the merit of their judicious arrangement and impartial narration. The Pickwick Papers are our New River Head, and we may be compared to the New River Company. The labors of others have raised for us an immense reservoir of important facts. We merely lay them on, and communicate them, in a clear and gentle stream, through the medium of these pages, to a world thirsting for Pickwickian knowledge. Acting in this spirit, and resolutely proceeding on our determination, to avow our obligations to the authorities we have consulted, we frankly say, that to the notebook of Mr. Snodgrass are we indebted for the particulars recorded in this, and the succeeding chapter particulars which, now that we have disburdened our consciences, we shall proceed to detail without further comment. The whole population of Rochester and the adjoining towns rose from their beds at an early hour of the following morning, in a state of the utmost bustle and excitement. A grand review was to take place upon the lines. The maneuvers of half a dozen regiments were to be inspected by the eagle eye of the commander-in-chief. Temporary fortifications had been erected, the citadel was to be attacked and taken, and a mine was to be sprung. Mr. Pickwick was, as our readers may have gathered from the slight extract we gave from his description of Chatham, an enthusiastic admirer of the army. Nothing could have been more delightful to him, nothing could have harmonized so well with the peculiar feeling of each of his companions as this sight. Accordingly, they were soon afoot, and walking in the direction of the scene of action, towards which crowds of people were already pouring from a variety of quarters. The appearance of everything on the lines denoted that the approaching ceremony was one of the utmost grandeur and importance. There were sentries posted to keep the ground for the troops, and servants on the batteries keeping places for the ladies, and sergeants running to and fro, with vellum-covered books under their arms, and Colonel Boulder, in full military uniform, on horseback, galloping first to one place, and then to another, and backing his horse among the people, and prancing, and curveting, and shouting in a most alarming manner, and making himself very hoarse in the voice, and very red in the face, without any assignable cause or reason whatever. Officers were running backwards and forwards, first communicating with Colonel Boulder, and then ordering the sergeants, and then running away altogether, and even the very privates themselves looked from behind their glazed stocks with an air of mysterious solemnity, which sufficiently bespoke the special nature of the occasion. Mr. Pickwick and his three companions stationed themselves in the front of the crowd, and patiently awaited the commencement of the proceedings. The throng was increasing every moment, and the efforts they were compelled to make, to retain the position they had gained, sufficiently occupied their attention during the 2 hours that ensued. At one time there was a sudden pressure from behind, and then Mr. Pickwick was jerked forward for several yards, with a degree of speed and elasticity highly inconsistent with the general gravity of his demeanor. At another moment there was a request to keep back from the front, and then the butt end of a musket was either dropped upon Mr. Pickwick's toe, to remind him of the demand, or thrust into his chest, to ensure its being complied with. Then some facetious gentleman on the left, after pressing sideways in a body, and squeezing Mr. Snodgrass into the very last extreme of human torture, would request to know vir he vos a shovin' to, and when Mr. Winkle had done expressing his excessive indignation at witnessing this unprovoked assault, some person behind would knock his hat over his eyes, and beg the favor of his putting his head in his pocket. These, and other practical witticisms, coupled with the unaccountable absence of Mr. Tubman, who had suddenly disappeared, and was nowhere to be found, rendered their situation upon the whole rather more uncomfortable than pleasing or desirable. At length that low roar of many voices ran through the crowd which usually announces the arrival of whatever they have been waiting for. All eyes were turned in the direction of the sally port. A few moments of eager expectation, and colors were seen fluttering gaily in the air, arms glistened brightly in the sun, column after column poured onto the plain. The troops halted and formed. The word of command rang through the line. There was a general clash of muskets as arms were presented, and the commander-in-chief, attended by Colonel Boulder and numerous officers, cantered to the front. The military band struck up altogether. The horses stood upon two legs each, cantered backwards, and whisked their tails about in all directions. The dogs barked, the mob screamed, the troops recovered, and nothing was to be seen on either side, as far as the eye could reach, but a long perspective of red coats and white trousers, fixed and motionless. Mr. Pickwick had been so fully occupied in falling about, and disentangling himself, miraculously, from between the legs of horses, that he had not enjoyed sufficient leisure to observe the scene before him, until it assumed the appearance we have just described. When he was at last enabled to stand firmly on his legs, his gratification and delight were unbounded. Can anything be finer or more delightful? ... he inquired of Mr. Winkle. Nothing, ... replied that gentleman, who had had a short man standing on each of his feet for the quarter of an hour immediately preceding. It is indeed a noble and a brilliant sight, ... said Mr. Snodgrass, in whose bosom a blaze of poetry was rapidly bursting forth, to see the gallant defenders of their country drawn up in brilliant array before its peaceful citizens, their faces beaming not with warlike ferocity, but with civilized gentleness, their eyes flashing not with the rude fire of rapine or revenge, but with the soft light of humanity and intelligence. ... Mr. Pickwick fully entered into the spirit of this eulogium, but he could not exactly re-echo its terms, for the soft light of intelligence burned rather feebly in the eyes of the warriors, inasmuch as the command eyes front had been given, and all the spectator saw before him was several thousand pair of optics, staring straight forward, wholly divested of any expression whatever. "We are in a capital situation now," ... said Mr. Pickwick, looking round him. The crowd had gradually dispersed in their immediate vicinity, and they were nearly alone. "Capital!" ... echoed both Mr. Snodgrass and Mr. Winkle. "What are they doing now?" ... inquired Mr. Pickwick, adjusting his spectacles. I rather think," ... said Mr. Winkle, changing color. "I rather think they are going to fire." ... "Nonsense," ... said Mr. Pickwick hastily. I really think they are," ... urged Mr. Snodgrass, somewhat alarmed. "Impossible," ... replied Mr. Pickwick. He had hardly uttered the word, when the whole half-dozen regiments leveled their muskets, as if they had but one common object, and that object the Pickwickians, and burst forth with the most awful and tremendous discharge that ever shook the earth to its centers, or an elderly gentleman off his. It was in this trying situation, exposed to a galling fire of blank cartridges, and harassed by the operations of the military, a fresh body of whom had begun to fall in on the opposite side, that Mr. Pickwick displayed that perfect coolness and self-possession, which are the indispensable accompaniments of a great mind. He seized Mr. Winkle by the arm, and placing himself between that gentleman and Mr. Snodgrass, earnestly besought them to remember that beyond the possibility of being rendered deaf by the noise, there was no immediate danger to be apprehended from the firing. But suppose some of the men should happen to have ball cartridges by mistake, remonstrated Mr. Winkle, pallid at the supposition he was himself conjuring up. I heard something whistle through the air now so sharp, close to my ear. Apostrophe, we had better throw ourselves on our faces, hadn't we? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Snodgrass. No, no, it's over now, apostrophe, said Mr. Pickwick. His lip might quiver, and his cheek might blanch, but no expression of fear or concern escaped the lips of that immortal man. Mr. Pickwick was right, the firing ceased, but he had scarcely time to congratulate himself on the accuracy of his opinion, when a quick movement was visible in the line. The hoarse shout of the word of command ran along it, and before either of the party could form a guess at the meaning of this new maneuver, the whole of the half-dozen regiments, with fixed bayonets, charged at double quick time down upon the very spot on which Mr. Pickwick and his friends were stationed. Man is but mortal, and there is a point beyond which human courage cannot extend. Mr. Pickwick gazed through his spectacles for an instant on the advancing mass, and then fairly turned his back, and we will not say fled. Firstly, because it is an ignoble term, and, secondly, because Mr. Pickwick's figure was by no means adapted for that mode of retreat. He trotted away at as quick a rate as his legs would convey him, so quickly, indeed, that he did not perceive the awkwardness of his situation to the full extent, until too late. The opposite troops, whose falling in had perplexed Mr. Pickwick a few seconds before, were drawn up to repel the mimic attack of the sham besiegers of the citadel, and the consequence was that Mr. Pickwick and his two companions found themselves suddenly enclosed between two lines of great length, the one advancing at a rapid pace, and the other firmly waiting the collision in hostile array. Hoy! Apostrophe, apostrophe, shouted the officers of the advancing line. Get out of the way. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried the officers of the stationary one. Where are we to go to? Apostrophe, apostrophe, screamed the agitated Pickwickians. Hoy, hoy, hoy. Apostrophe, apostrophe, was the only reply. There was a moment of intense bewilderment, a heavy tramp of footsteps, a violent concussion, a smothered laugh. The half-dozen regiments were half a thousand yards off, and the soles of Mr. Pickwick's boots were elevated in air. Mr. Snodgrass and Mr. Winkle had each performed a compulsory somerset with remarkable agility, when the first object that met the eyes of the latter as he sat on the ground, staunching with a yellow silk handkerchief the stream of life which issued from his nose, was his venerated leader at some distance off, running after his own hat, which was gambolling playfully away in perspective. There are very few moments in a man's existence when he experiences so much ludicrous distress, or meets with so little charitable commiseration, as when he is in pursuit of his own hat. A vast deal of coolness, and a peculiar degree of judgment, are requisite in catching a hat. A man must not be precipitate, or he runs over it. He must not rush into the opposite extreme, or he loses it altogether. The best way is to keep gently up with the object of pursuit, to be wary and cautious, to watch your opportunity well, get gradually before it, then make a rapid dive, seize it by the crown, and stick it firmly on your head, smiling pleasantly all the time, as if you thought it as good a joke as anybody else. There was a fine gentle wind, and Mr. Pickwick's hat rolled sportively before it. The wind puffed, and Mr. Pickwick puffed, and the hat rolled over and over as merrily as a lively porpoise in a strong tide. And on it might have rolled, far beyond Mr. Pickwick's reach, had not its course been providentially stopped, just as that gentleman was on the point of resigning it to its fate. Mr. Pickwick, we say, was completely exhausted, and about to give up the chase, when the hat was blown with some violence against the wheel of a carriage, which was drawn up in a line with half a dozen other vehicles on the spot to which his steps had been directed. Mr. Pickwick, perceiving his advantage, darted briskly forward, secured his property, planted it on his head, and paused to take breath. He had not been stationary half a minute when he heard his own name eagerly pronounced by a voice, which he at once recognized as Mr. Tubman's, and, looking upwards, he beheld a sight which filled him with surprise and pleasure. In an open barrage, the horses of which had been taken out, the better to accommodate it to the crowded place, stood a stout old gentleman, in a blue coat and bright buttons, corduroy breeches and top boots, two young ladies in scarfs and feathers, a young gentleman apparently enamored of one of the young ladies in scarfs and feathers, a lady of doubtful age, probably the aunt of the aforesaid, and Mr. Tubman, as easy and unconcerned, as if he had belonged to the family from the first moments of his infancy. Fastened up behind the barrage was a hamper of spacious dimensions, one of those hampers which always awakens in a contemplative mind associations connected with cold fowls, tongues, and bottles of wine, and on the box sat a fat and red-faced boy, in a state of somnolency, whom no speculative observer could have regarded for an instant without setting down as the official dispenser of the contents of the before-mentioned hamper, when the proper time for their consumption should arrive. Mr. Pickwick had bestowed a hasty glance on these interesting objects, when he was again greeted by his faithful disciple. "Pickwick, Pickwick," apostrophe said Mr. Tubman, "come up here. Make haste. Apostrophe, come along, sir. Pray, come up," apostrophe said the stout gentleman. "Joe. Damn that boy, he's gone to sleep again. Joe, let down the steps." Apostrophe the fat boy rolled slowly off the box, let down the steps, and held the carriage door invitingly open. Mr. Snodgrass and Mr. Winkle came up at the moment. "Room for you all, gentlemen," apostrophe said the stout man. "Two inside, and one out. Joe, make room for one of these gentlemen on the box. Now, sir, come along," apostrophe, and the stout gentleman extended his arm, and pulled first Mr. Pickwick, and then Mr. Snodgrass, into the barrage by main force. Mr. Winkle mounted to the box, the fat boy waddled to the same perch, and fell fast asleep instantly. "Well, gentlemen," apostrophe said the stout man, "very glad to see you. Know you very well, gentlemen, though you mayn't remember me. I spent some evenings at your club last winter, picked up my friend Mr. Tubman here this morning, and very glad I was to see him. Well, sir, and how are you? You do look uncommon well, to be sure." Apostrophe, Mr. Pickwick acknowledged the compliment, and cordially shook hands with the stout gentleman in the top boots. "Well, and how are you, sir?" apostrophe said the stout gentleman. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.